You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, May 1st, 2023. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live
steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Quinn Slobidian, professor of the history of ideas at Wesley College, author of Crack Up, Capitalism, Market Radicals, and the Dream of a World Without Democracy. Also on the program today, more revelations of ethical violations on the Supreme Court, as the Senate Judiciary Committee will be having a hearing on such issues tomorrow. Speaking of the Supreme Court has decided to hear a case that will strike at the heart of the power of federal agencies. The Chevron Doctrine is now officially in the crosshairs. First Republic Bank goes belly up, sold to J.P. Morgan Chase, just months after First Republic said, we don't need no stinking regulations. Fed to meet hints at raising rates despite inflation slowing down, making it clear their job number one, disciplining labor. Conservatives have played Kevin McCarthy once again. They got their budget and they still want a debt limit crisis. Gunman in Texas kills five over a noise complaint. Ron DeTedious has traveled the world in a quixotic search for someone who finds him impressive. Tim Scott teases his vice presidential run announcement, which apparently will be in a month from now. And Russian attacks, more cruise missiles sent to Ukrainian cities. Lastly, Epstein's private diary names names, including Noam Chomsky. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. The beginning of this week, if it's anything like last week, it's going to be a bumpy ride, but maybe a fun one. Emma Vigeland.
Hello.
Last week, still echoing. Apparently, Steven Crowder refused to give up the ghost. He put in another salvo. I have to say, I don't want to spend any time on this right now. We're going to get to it in the fun half. But I really feel like we've learned something about Crowder that we sort of knew, but it's really becoming clear. The guy is an effing idiot. Mm-hmm. I mean, aside from everything else, which I feel like I was pretty clear on, he doesn't seem to have any clue as to what he's doing.
I mean, he's consulting with his dad who raised him like this.
Yeah. Honestly, there is, there is a Shakespearean quality to this. I feel like this is sort of Macbeth, right? What's the story? Like, what's the
why is it like Macbeth?
I don't know.
Like it's Richard the Third. I'm not sure.
Maybe it's Richard the Third. It's just a classic, like where the tragic flaw, is the same thing that got Crowder where he was is exactly the same thing that's going to tear him down.
Okay, that's like Richard the Third. Yeah. Because I'm like, if it's Macbeth, who's Lady Macbeth in this instance? Is it Crowder?
I'll find out.
It's Candace Owens.
There we go.
All right, let's get to this. There's a lot around the Supreme Court right now. I think we're going to be talking to Ian Millhiser on Wednesday. Over the weekend, new revelations about more ethical issues with the Supreme Court. You heard about Gorsuch having his real estate bought 9 days after he was sworn into the court, real estate that he couldn't move for 2 years. Just a coincidence, folks.
Didn't disclose who bought it either, but disclosed the cowboy boots.
Fair to disclose stuff. I mean, failed. You know, it happens.
Yeah, paperwork issue.
Clarence Thomas, whose record of ethical violations goes back over 10 years when Breyer and Scalia testified in 2011. To the same issues that Thomas still has in involving that guy, the billionaire Crow. You also remember Scalia. Where did he die? He was in like some billionaire's, retreat.
Hunting retreat, yeah.
We also have Sam Alito going out there whining and crying that nobody's respecting the court, claiming that he knows who the leaker is of the Dobbs ruling, which I bet he does. Because he probably sees him every morning when he gets up into and looks into the mirror.
I was about to say, was that his quote when looking at himself, pointing?
Let's remember that it is quite established that he leaked the ruling in the the case involving birth control on the
Hobby Lobby
case. The person who received the leaks has told us so. We also know that someone, and it was probably from Alito's camp, complained to the Wall Street Journal back in 2012 in the wake of the ACA thing. I mean, he has a history of doing this.
Yeah.
And somehow the Supreme Court investigation went nowhere, but he knows.
And it's a liberal. That's my favorite part, too. He's like, it's definitely not a bald white man. It's a liberal woman.
Did he say it was a liberal?
I think so, right? Did he hint that it was someone trying to weaken the court? Or maybe I'm
Well,
wrong.
He hinted that it was not anybody. It was someone who was trying to undercut the brief. But I don't think he characterized exactly who that person was. But, I mean, he's a liar.
Yeah.
Well, he said in the Post report here, he said he was sure the leak was a part of an effort to prevent the Dobbs draft from becoming the decision of the court. And that's how it was used for those 6 weeks by people on the outside as part of the campaign to try to intimidate the court.
Yeah. Now, it's one thing that it was used on the outside. It was certainly not used on the inside. And I find it hard to believe. I mean, we know how this works. He was looking to lock people in. It's just absurd. Absurd. Here is Ted Cruz dealing with that, you know, having to address at least some of the ethical violations. He leaves out all the rest because Clarence Thomas is the most sort of like sympathetic figure, or the way that Ted Cruz can twist it. And I got to say, kudos to Ted Cruz for going on with Maria Bartiromo, particularly since we know of like all the sort of back channel that they have because of that Dominion stuff. All right, let's play this clip.
Three conservative Supreme Court justices are under investigation for ethics. They are attacking Clarence Thomas. Did Clarence Thomas do something wrong?
No, you know what Justice Thomas did wrong? He's been one of the greatest Supreme Court justices ever to serve on the court. He has been a principled constitutionalist, and the left despises him. Democrats hate Justice Thomas, and they save a special degree of hate for him because he's a black man. And their view is that African American is not allowed to be a conservative, is not allowed to disagree with left-wing orthodoxy. You know, Justice Antonin Scalia, whom I knew well, was every bit as conservative as Justice Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
The left didn't heap that kind of contempt on Justice Scalia. Justice Thomas, they view as a traitor because he is African-American and he's an extraordinary justice.
How disgusting.
And listen.
Thank you, Maria.
I want to make something absolutely clear that what is there something wrong with my camera?
Yeah, you just started glitching a little bit. It looked like, so I'm going to cut to Emma, but you can still talk.
Okay. Well, let me make something clear. On the day that Scalia died, I celebrated openly on this program. I mean, not because I want people to die, but because the fact of the matter is his death was very helpful to millions of people, probably.
Yeah.
It's just absurd.
Absolutely. I love Ted Cruz here, representative for black people in this country, saying suddenly very concerned about racism. Wasn't the Republican Party and Ted Cruz even specifically bemoaning the fact that Biden had pre-announced that he was going to put a black woman on the Supreme Court in Ketanji Brown Jackson? And then they use it to their advantage with extreme cynicism. So, yeah, obviously the ethical concerns about Clarence Thomas are incredibly valid. You're back.
And everybody's also, I mean, I would also add, not only we, I have equal disdain for Gorsuch and Roberts, I would say Sam Alito is my least favorite. And, you know, look, hate is a strong word, but I'll use it. I mean, I don't hate him personally, although I'm sure if I knew him, I would. But I don't know him personally. I just know him as a completely ethically challenged Supreme Court justice who sits upon his throne and provides edicts. One other note about the Supreme Court. They have taken a case that deals with fisheries. It is one of the more boring, like, sounding cases you could imagine. It's basically there is a law that requires the fisheries to have a monitor on certain fishing boats, big, big, big ones. The agency that is tasked with administrating this has imposed a fee on the shipping, on the fisheries, or on the fishermen, as it were, the fishing companies, to pay for that monitor. That in and of itself is not necessarily earth-shattering, but there was a direct challenge to Chevron, where the Supreme Court was asked to take up the question as to whether this is an exception to Chevron or to overturn Chevron. Chevron is the doctrine that came out of a case involving Chevron. I can't remember who the defendant was in that instance, where essentially the Supreme Court decided that when Congress has not been absolutely explicit about every detail, however, have legislated certain regulations and authorities to the federal agency, that the federal agents, because they're experts, can decide, and we're going to defer to that as a court. And that is basically what allows our country to function in this, to allows our country to function. And the, in other words, like, you know, EPA, make sure the water is clean. But when the Congress passes that law, they don't know the different chemicals that could be dumped into the water. So they can't say, make sure it's clean. And the definition of clean is no ethyl monochlorocysteine, no, you know, barium, no whatever. I'm just making up chemicals. I don't know what they are. But the point is, there are chemicals that they would never even anticipate could be in the water. And if Congress is responsible every time to say what specific chemicals being in the water would constitute not clean water, we would never have clean water. So they defer to the EPA. The Chevron doctrine is what protects that deference, and it may be going away. We'll be talking to Ian Belheiser about more about that.
Funded by the Cato Institute. That shouldn't shock you, right?
No, of course not. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we get back, we'll be talking to Quinn Slobodian, professor of history of ideas at Wellesley College, author of Crack Up Capitalism, Market Radicals, and the Dream of a World Without Democracy, just after I read from this sponsor. Somebody keeps trying to call me, and I cannot turn off my phone, like four different calls. Folks, as you know, we're living in an age with increasing authoritarianism. The internet is at the frontier of that battle for control. You've got corporations want more and more information. It's not like we live in Europe where they, you know, when I got back from Europe, all my my computer, my iPad, I'm still sometimes getting asked, like, do you want cookies and I get the option of saying no.
Oh, that's nice. I was trying to figure out a way to get rid of cookies the other day.
It's we just, you know what you got to do? Get your Congress to take control like we've seen in Europe. But in the meantime, if you want to protect your privacy, ExpressVPN. Large corporations want to track what you do online, what you're searching for, the videos you watch, everything you click, et cetera, et cetera. They can match your activity to your true identity using your device unique IP address. When you use ExpressVPN, they can't see your IP address at all. Your identity is anonymized by a secure VPN server. This is also very good if, let's say, you want to watch the Australian version of Survivor and you find out that it's not available on any of your devices until you do your one click on ExpressVPN, which I will also tell you, you can put on your smart TV. Super easy. And then all of a sudden, as far as they're concerned, you are might as well be in Australia. ExpressVPN encrypts 100% of your network traffic for protection from hackers and eavesdroppers. ExpressVPN is super easy to use. Again, the app has one button. You tap it, you're protected. That simple. Done. Don't give big tech and big government the power to control your information. Defend your rights and protect yourself at expressvpn.com/majority. That's expressvpn.com/majority. You will get 3 months free. expressvpn.com/majority. As always, we'll put that in the YouTube and podcast description and on the website. We'll be right back after this with Quinn Slobidian. Be right back. We are back, Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Welcoming back to the program, Quinn Slobidian. He is a professor of history of ideas at Wellesley College, author of Crack Up, Capitalism, Market Radicals, and the Dream of a World Without Democracy. Quinn, welcome back to the program. I was just saying, I think we spoke last, maybe, I guess it was 5 years ago, with your book, Globalists, which I found... it's just one of those books that I think has been a touchstone, and you know, particularly as we went through a long period, it feels like, of trying to understand really, you know, what has taken place over the past 30, 40 years in terms of neoliberalism in this country and where it came from. And we should say Globalist is a great perspective on that, that both taught me about the globalist perspective of libertarianism, but made me understand what genuine neoliberal, I guess, economics ideology is all about. So thank you for that.
You're welcome.
this is sort of like a sequel, right? I mean, it's sort of like it is sort of following almost the bastardization of what was a not very good idea as it mutates into almost its pure essence in some way.
Yeah. In fact, Hayek's Bastards was a working title at some point of the book, because I think part of what made the globalist book kind of land for a lot of people is that it appeared at kind of this moment where the common sense seemed to be shifting, came out in 2018. And until, you know, very recently before 2018, we all just assumed that politicians would just keep kind of kowtowing to the forces of globalization, like in perpetuity. There was just like a horizon out to the future where they would act like it was just the shifting of the tides and the changing of the seasons. But then I think first with Bernie, and then Bernie kind of pickpocketed by Bannon and Trump, a lot of those ideas about common sense globalization got thrown into question in 2016. And then by 2018, it was like, oh, this thing that looked like it was going to be the future is now a piece of history. So in the wake of that, now writing this more recent book, Crack Up Capitalism, I was kind of trying to figure out, like, where does market radicalism go next? I mean, if the idea of encasing a world economy against democratic threats was one sort of century-long dream, which was in a way realized but then shattered, what's the next kind of utopia for the hard right libertarian world? So the contents of the book is sort of unpack that. Utopia.
Was the Trans-Pacific Partnership sort of a prime example of that dream being shattered? And if so, will you just characterize that dream so we can sort of, you know, go from Milton Friedman, I guess, to his son, to his grandson, and just watch the sort of the progression there? Because there does seem to be a loyalty to a central concept. It's just in practice how it's deployed is a little bit different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I have this sort of one-liner about what neoliberalism is, which is just the ongoing effort to protect capitalism from democracy. And the solution then sort of changes as the conditions change. You know, sometimes you scale up and try to create sort of multilateral trade deals that lock in certain kinds of freedoms and prevent others. At other times you do what I'm describing in the book, which is you kind of opt out, or you create new little statelets, you create new sort of things at the seams of sovereignty. So I think that the Trans-Pacific Partnership you mentioned was very much a turning point. The interesting thing, or the usefulness of focusing in on these trade deals, I think, is it puts paid to the idea that the globalization era was about unfettered markets, or like setting markets free, as it was often put. One of the main points of globalists was to sort of point out that globalization has always been encased by an ever proliferating number of laws, institutions, authorities that allow, you know, certain kinds of exchange and make impossible others. So the trade deals are a perfect example of that, right? They're not freeing markets. They're actually making markets accumulate profits for certain groups. They do things like encasing intellectual property rights, making impossible things which used to be normal, like poorer countries using software, using patents that would otherwise be protected only nationally. So the moment at which someone like Hillary Clinton actually herself turned away from the TPP, I think that was really a moment you knew the sea change had happened, and it has just continued to happen. I mean, I was talking to my students just today about the attitude towards free trade, which as recently as 4 years ago, I think, was it was very much a deviation to think about needing to start a trade war with China for any reason whatsoever. And now you can't find a politician who's not going to agree that there's some kind of economic, if not military, conflicts happening with China, you know, often for worse.
Well, in terms of free trade, I mean, that in and of itself is also, like, as you almost just explained just before that, is sort of a misnomer, right? It really isn't so much free trade as much as it is like, we're going to decide the terms of trade that are really more advantageous to us. We're not unshackling any type of, like, it's not just a question of, like, rolling back tariffs. It's almost as if, like, there was, like, a shift from what was a sort of a fake category, right? Free or fettered trade, because all trade is fettered, or it's not free of anything other than maybe it's like less friction for certain like participants within the context of that exchange. Mm-hmm. And then it just jumped categories, like almost like people said, oh, well, we don't want free trade, but we were never really talking about free trade. That was just a misnomer. Can you just sort of like broaden that out too, so that people understand? Sure.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of ways of taking that further. One, I would say, is if you think about free trade in terms of, you know, reducing the barriers to trade, so making it easier for people to get goods from other parts of the world rather than just their own, then even there was this as I call it in the book, kind of an encasement feature there. The best example of this is the emergence of investment law and so-called investor-state dispute settlements, ISDS, which introduced the possibility that corporations could sue countries for profits that were lost when countries changed their internal laws. So say you do something like you increase the rate of taxation to be able to pay for more public health or public education. And a multinational corporation that has set up a factory or a mine now stands to lose more of their profit. Well, they can sue you under ISDS and international investment law. And that, you know, is a certain kind of freedom, certainly.
Let me just add too, like if we were to say, oh, you know what, we're finding that the level of mercury that we put into the air is actually like creating more birth defects with children than we care for, and mm-hmm. we raise the standards on mercury, mm-hmm. theoretically under that ISDS, we can be sued as a country. And mm-hmm. this, we should also say, this is also for localities too. Like if the state mm-hmm. of Wisconsin decides to raise those standards, you know, we're not going to allow as much lead and candy coming from a company, you know, from factories overseas.
Right.
They can be sued. I mean, it's just, it's nuts. And we get this with Canada and Mexico a little bit still, mm-hmm. because there was some of that under NAFTA. But I'm mm-hmm. sorry, continue. I just wanted to.
There was a lot of that under NAFTA. And in fact, you know, the one sort of bright light for even some progressives in the otherwise bleak years of the Trump administration was actually the rewriting of NAFTA to take out a lot of that ISDS. So the U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer, who is very much a Republican, but also introduced some probably common sense measures which have been carried over actually into the Biden administration. So there's that one thing, which is like, well, this kind of free trade is actually just empowering private actors, often against democratically elected sovereigns or states. But then there's also, to me, the starkest example is intellectual property law, because I've written a bit about this, how even if you look in the ranks of people like Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek and James Buchanan, the sort of high priests of neoliberal thought, even they are skeptical and oftentimes outright critical of the idea of having super long patents or copyrights that apply all over the world. Because if you're interested in the kind of efficient allocation of, you know, human intelligence and creativity, it actually doesn't make sense to let a few people just sit on the rents for, you know, perpetuity for 100 years, for 150 years. So I have a chapter in another collection where I'm talking about Friedman and Buchanan, people like that, actually writing letters to the court as friends of the court, sort of protesting the extension of copyrights. This becomes obviously especially hardcore for emerging markets and developing countries, which it up until the 1990s, in many cases, were able to do things like develop homegrown software, so homegrown kind of hardware in some cases, because IP wasn't regulated globally, but now it is. So it's really not, I think the free trade is really a misnomer. It's about empowering often private actors against public actors and about certain kinds of freedom and not others.
How did you observe this kind of shift away from the orthodoxy manifesting itself with both parties? Because quickly globalists became Jews for the Republican Party, right? That term. And Trump did have a trade war with China. You know, we can debate the merits of that as well. Mm-hmm. But for the Democratic Party, I think that that's an even more interesting conversation mm-hmm. to see how they responded. Because as you say, it's mm-hmm. been like 5 years, and it shifted more quickly than a lot of things in American politics.
Yeah, I mean, I think it came in phases, right? I mean, 2016, there was a lot of talk about how the neoliberal consensus had just blown up and we were in a new era. And I was being asked myself a lot around that time whether or not I agreed. And I would tend to say no, because it seemed that even if, you know, Trump was starting what was a pretty kind of scattershot trade war, I mean, don't forget, it wasn't just with China, it was also with Canada and the EU, and under the idea that Canada was now a national security threat because they were producing aluminum, which you might need in the case of war. So that seemed like maybe more of a exception rather than the rule of a Trumpist economic orthodoxy, which seemed to be mostly interested in old think tank favorites of massive tax cuts and keeping sort of freewheeling finance going. The fact that the trade reorientation carried over into the Biden administration and then really got kind of supercharged by the confrontations with the COVID pandemic meant that this idea of reshoring, increasing resilience, increasing kind of domestic industrial capacity got turned from a kind of sort of ethno-nationalist, sort of xenophobic-driven economic decision-making thing to a more broad-based reconceptualization of what the economy was for, right? I mean, the idea that you would now attach things like getting CHIPS money or IRA money to doing things like providing daycare or providing, you know, living wages, trying to ensure representation for unions, suggests that it's not just using the trade war as like a blunt instrument against your adversaries, but it's a kind of attempt to rethink what the market should be, you know, who for in whose name the market should be operating. So yeah, that consensus has consolidated very, very quickly. I think it has to do with a lot of people at the kind of advisory level inside the Biden administration in the kind of administrative staffing world, many of whom are often kind of old Clintonite style neoliberals who had a kind of awakening moment at some point in the course of the Trump years and the COVID pandemic. And now are sort of trying to clamber their way to a new paradigm. So in my opinion, it's largely for the good. I mean, I think this is a kind of a confrontation with the material effects of globalization, which has been long overdue. The speaking to people as workers and not just as consumers out for like a cheap flat screen TV, I think is a great advancement of the national conversation. But it definitely still, I mean, as you signaled by this idea of like the conflation of globalists with Jews and the anti-Semitic slur, it always does threaten to tip over into something that would be extremely problematic. So one needs to like, you know, kind of corral the messaging around it, obviously pretty
but careful. even the consensus you describe I find to be a bit problematic because that seems just Cold War redux. Like, I mean, I'm happy that consensus about trade has shifted so rapidly, but the context in which it's now kind of manifesting itself is concerning because it's just about militarism with China.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways it's very hard to get around because there has been only kind of one way to deviate from a call for openness or liberal markets in American economic history, and that is to call on what was often called the national security exception. So from like kind of 1945 up until recently, you know, the only way you could sort of get around a mandate for lowering tariffs or liberalizing trade was to say, well, it's important for national security reasons to protect this or that sector of the economy. So in a way, you know, that's what had been more of a loophole is now just becoming expanded ever larger to like threaten to swallow the entire way that people think about the relationship with other economic markets, which is absolutely perilous. I mean, I'm completely with you. I think the last few weeks have been actually pretty pivotal for this because Jake Sullivan, the national security advisor, has been out in front of the cameras trying to walk back that kind of a language. He himself had actually helped to ramp up a lot of the anti-China stuff, I think, over the last few years and say, use that as a way to get Republicans on board, basically, for a kind of a post-neoliberal paradigm shift. But now there's with this threat of it getting away from them, I think there's the hope that they can kind of put those horses back in the barn and make this more of about economic health rather than just geopolitical conflict. But I have no sort of secret formula there except just to say that every time, you know, I think people talk about the care economy, they should also mention the fact that this is not a kind of xenophobic crusade. And this is not actually about the zero-sum relationship between the Chinese people and the American people. I think the leftist perspective is to see that Chinese workers are structurally in the same relationship to capital as American workers are, and to try to think about how you can create bonds of solidarity and mutual interest across those divides. But unfortunately, I don't see a lot of people beyond small groups like Justice is Global kind of being really conscious about that trans-border worker organizing.
Just one more question in this sort of like silo as we move forward, but can that sort of tightrope you're talking about in the case of China, for instance, because I think that's where it's really is the focal point of it, is the analogy or the metaphor basically like we're going to onshore chip making here, but we're not going to be so harsh to the extent that any American or Western interests participate in chip making in China. I mean, is it like, I mean, because it does feel like the onshoring of the chip making is important. We saw, you know, the logistic issues with something like COVID, and you know, you don't want an entire country reliant on something that's, you know, Wuhan gets a sneeze and we don't have cars for 2 years or something. I mean, that's, you know, understandable on some level. But also maybe there was a more amenable way of going about doing that.
Yeah. I mean, in that particular case, of course, the semiconductor chip stuff has been huge. And the competitor or the source is not China, it's Taiwan, right? Which almost makes it more complicated. I mean, they're overwhelmingly the world's biggest producer, and both China and the U.S. are dependent then on the same small island, which the Chinese obviously have what they see as a historical claim to. So tactically, it makes a lot of sense to try to replicate that capacity here in the U.S., arguably just so you don't feel like you need to go to war in the Taiwan Straits to protect your chips being shipped, you know, for the next round of EV production. So I think, you know, it makes sense to kind of expand domestic capacity to decrease entanglements of that kind. I think that it is possible to think about a kind of ramped down two-speed kind of version of global economic cooperation. People have been proposing this stuff for years. I mean, Danny Roderick at Harvard is a good example of someone who for 20 plus years has been saying globalization is good in the sense that international division of labor can be good for everybody under the right conditions. But when you make strong demands, like, you know, all of our products need to be completely protected all the way inside of your economy, and we need to be able to go in and regulate sort of copyrights and patents, then people are going to be deterred and eventually turn away. So you need to have a kind of low level version of international economic integration. So what that Goldilocks formula is anyone's guess. I think a lot of Democrats have made the wager that the only way you're going to get the Republicans on board with this stuff is if you attach it to a kind of China hawkery. I hope that not everyone who uses that kind of rhetoric sort of feels it in their heart, so to speak, but they're probably being slightly realistic that if there's any way of sort of getting this over the finish line, it's through that.
There's been a lot of prep for that. There's been a lot of prep for that too. I mean, I would argue the Iraq War was the beginnings of that, but we saw under the Obama administration the pivot to Asia with the TPP as part of it, which was to isolate China, for instance, and you know, in terms of our military or our,
and that
our
was
Navy.
The plan before 9/11 too, the pivot to Asia as well.
I mean, I think certainly by the neocons.
The last thing that's worth saying is like, there's a lot of, it's easy to say the words like decoupling or delinking or reshoring, and these are popular pieces of jargon, but actually doing it is very hard. So even as China tries, or America tries to isolate China by, let's say, moving production to places like Vietnam, often China then just is intermediating whatever production is happening just one step further than it had been when they were directly manufacturing inside of China. So the IR scholars Henry Farrell and Abraham Newman have a nice phrase of chained globalization, that there's sort of a way that interdependencies that have already built up, whether it's like a semiconductor industry that took decades and decades and billions of dollars to set up, you just can't do that overnight. You can't undo that overnight. And the United States has the dollar system working in its advantage too, which is for even countries like China very hard to extricate themselves from. So I think the most important thing is to kind of get away from the fantasy that you can somehow press a button and be detached from the rest of the world. This is not something that can be done. The best you can do is hope for the most humane conditions under which it can happen.
All right. Well, that was a good table setting for your latest book. Let's talk about this. In this instance, instead of sort of Mont Pelerin, I guess, agenda of having governments shape a market that will be conducive to certain business, I guess, interests. This is a an attempt to sort of like throw the yoke of government off. I mean, this is sort of like the more sort of the bastards of Hayek, I guess, as you would, as you almost titled your book, like, and it involves essentially like what I think people would be familiar with as the enterprise zones, or, you know, zones. Take it from there, and we'll go into some of these case studies.
Sure. I mean, I guess it's worth sort of setting up why I would do this too. I mean, so I'm a historian, meaning I'm always sort of trying to figure out what the stories that are that we're telling ourselves about the past and even the recent past. And there was a couple of stories about the recent past that I found really unsatisfying. And so the book and its subject was kind of a way to try to think my way out of those. And one of those stories is about the world since the end of the Cold War. So I think that especially since 2016, this very unhelpful kind of before and after story developed, which was that from the fall of the Berlin Wall to 2016, there was kind of a Coca-Cola style globalization and increasing economic integration, and markets all grew more close together. I was in Atlanta the other year, and there's like the Human Rights Museum and then the world of Coca-Cola are like 5 minutes walk from each other. And I was like, this is the capital of the 1990s, I think, in the popular imagination. And then supposedly 2016 came up and like blew it all up, and we were now disintegrating. That just didn't work for me. I'm unpersuaded by those broad narratives in general. And when I started looking back at the 90s, just day to day, week to week reportage, I mean, it was all about fear of fragmentation. Yugoslavia was falling apart. The Soviet Union was obviously falling apart. Somalia was stateless for a decade. It was an era where there was a real fear of like political crack up, even at the same time that people were talking about economic, you know, knitting together and economic integration. So it was that paradox I was really fascinated by, is how are we focused on the economic story and missed the way that the political crack up was actually long brewing. So my favorite example is that the League of the South, you know, the neo-Confederate group in the United States, took its name from Lega Nord, the Italian neo-nationalist party that was recently in power. Because they were looking at Europe. This is like, look at this. They're creating new states. They're creating new ethnic polities all the time. Why can't we bring that back to the United States? So part of it was like, get back to that spirit of disintegration that was so animating the decade. But the other one was really about this idea that that free market radicals would always be interested in kind of scaling up, right? The globalists in the far right slur sense, that somehow we were all sort of subject to the machinations of a small number of puppet masters. And this is something that I think in the collective isolation and the madness of 2020 really started to suck in, I think, ever more people, probably, a lot of people, even a couple degrees from all three of us, have probably been drawn into this kind of maelstrom of that was often focusing on the one especially photogenic figure of Klaus Schwab at the head of the World Economic Forum, who was supposedly created the whole pandemic from the outset as part of the Great Reset. And so this idea that market radicalism was all about global puppet masters was like ever more unsatisfactory to me, if not the wrong way that we should be taking sort of critiques and debates, which led me to the gang of people I talk about in my new book, which is about people who had a very different attitude towards the 1990s. Basically, they saw the 90s happen, the WTO, NAFTA, the EU, and they were people who prized economic freedom above all. But instead of celebrating and thinking like, hooray, we won, the Cold War is over, capitalism is the only choice, they actually thought the opposite. This is, you know, the first big twist you need to get your head around to understand where these Hayek's bastards sort of get their ideas, is that actually the fact that communism is gone is bad because now the communists have gone undercover and they're doing other stuff now. Communism has gone from red to green. It's now environmentalism. It's feminism. It's the civil rights movement. It's demands for affirmative action, the protection of people with disabilities. And the globalists, as they would then happily call them, are actually now a bunch of socialists. They're not capitalists. So what do you do? Well, you have to get out and you need to create new small versions of sort of secessionist zones. You need to create, do laboratories for opting out in places like gated communities. So one of my chapters is about how excited the kind of libertarian world was about the proliferation of gated communities and homeowners associations in the 1990s, because they looked like experiments in private government, right? It wasn't one person, one vote. It was like shares based on how much property you had, whether, how big your unit was, right? These things all then were things that determined how much power you had inside of the private mini state of the gated community as they saw it. And the book then becomes a kind of a tour through these examples of people thinking that they can kind of opt out, create a purely private capitalist community without any trace of representative government or democracy, and the great lengths that they had to go to find such places. So the most dramatic example is probably the Dutch guy who tries to set up like a stateless anarcho-capitalist society in Somalia in the middle of the Civil War, creates what he calls a white man's business clan, grafting kind of Somali customary law onto 21st century contract law. So there's all of these like really strange hybrids of kind of archaic forms like medieval law, Somali customary law, attaching them to the needs of capitalism that to me capture the way that the kind of the collective timeline that we'd all been marching on some idea of progress and like kind of Whiggish understandings, or even the United Nations idea of like, here are a bunch of national flags, here are a bunch of countries. It might take a while, but eventually they will all develop towards the same industrialized endpoint. I think one of the other things that happened after the Cold War is that assumption just blew apart. And the idea of places being permanently different for people like anarcho-capitalists and market radicals ended up being very attractive, because it was like, hey, if we have endless fragmentation, potentially thousands of polities, then it's like a smorgasbord of policy options, and we can go find the ones that protect our economic freedoms better than any of the others.
There's a lot. I want to get ultimately to like, you know, how much of this was a desire to sort of like scale it up, or to actually just live it, my own existence. Like, am I actually doing a model future of the world, or am I like, this is the best way for me to live? But before we get there, like, there's also, I mean, I'm hesitant to say this, but it sort of also feels like when I, you know, 6 to 10 years ago, when I would debate libertarians, European libertarians would always show up and go like, who are these people that you're debating? Like, these are, you know, like American, it's sort of like there's an American strain of libertarianism that is wedded with, you know, the Murray Rothbards. You know, he was the guy who was, he was also like, I think he was doing some of the newsletter stuff for Ron Paul.
Yeah.
And that sort of strain that sort of took on a weird sort of derivation of libertarianism. And I wonder, I guess, like, do we have those things moving in parallel, or is it that there was sort of always an undercurrent? Cause I just ran into something today, Milton Friedman, who came up with the idea of vouchers, specifically after Brown versus Board of Education.
Yeah.
And it wasn't so much of it was an economic sort of proposal, but it was also, I think he was pretty explicit, like, this is going to allow people to have all white schools.
He says that. I mean, it's
exactly.
You don't have to infer it. It says that.
Exactly. And so that seems to sort of like, that's where these sort of two sort of traditions, like the John Birch Society and, you know, the classical neoliberal sort of vision sort of meld and turn into, you know, I guess Friedman's grandson, who's like, he's not quite seasteading. Where is it from my notes?
He's hoping I mean, he started the Seasteading Institute, so.
Right, there it is. I mean,
it's not gone far. But yeah, no, the steading in it sort of says a lot, right? Because this what you're describing as the kind of distinctive American trait is really just the myth of the frontier, which is also nothing more or less than just the ideology of settler colonialism. The idea that there's always some sort of empty space out there that one can move to and sort of do these small scale experiments in living and, you know, keep the undesirables at bay. I mean, there's a very clear lineage for that in the United States. But one of the things the book is really trying to bring in is that also has a very long history in Britain. In their case, it's the edge of empire, rather than, you know, the American continent. And it's, the book begins with Hong Kong. Singapore is the third chapter. The idea of a kind of freewheeling, entrepreneurial, self-made person going out into the supposedly unmarked territory and carving out a little strange legal jurisdiction that is really makes it attractive for people to come and trade there or to invest there. And then people back in the metropole sort of looking admiringly at them. I mean, this is very much part of British imperial culture, whether it's the Stamford Raffles starting Singapore in the 1850s as part of the British East India Company, or Cecil Rhodes, you know, in Southern Africa, having eventually what was a whole nation named after him, Rhodesia, lasted until, you know, almost into our lifetimes. So there is that story too. I'm trying to sort of bring together the sort of frontier settler colonial side of libertarianism, which I think is always there. And which, interestingly enough, doesn't presuppose, I think, that everyone is going to eventually follow that way of organizing their lives or societies. I think the free to choose in the famous Friedman phrasing is supposed to be, you know, free to choose amongst styles of society within which we'd like to live. And if there's one thing that all the people in my book kind of agree on is that there should be more options of places that one can choose from. The question then is, who has the means to move? Who has the resources? Who has the ability to kind of pull up stakes and move based on incentives or, you know, taste structure or whatever? And the answer is like very few people. That doesn't bother them. I mean, that's not itself an obstacle to their argument. It's an argument for an elite and with an understood social Darwinist undertone, which is the very process of sorting will, you know, select for the most able and the most fit, and those who are not will be sort of disposed of sort of territorially. They'll end up in places that can't reproduce them as, and that is in many cases of the things I write not shied away from. It's something that people see as one of the virtues of this model of kind of constant population churn and territorial reorganization. And that, I mean, that comes out very clearly, for example, in the chapter I have on late apartheid South Africa, which I think in terms of new stories sort of being brought into the historical record, that's probably the one that I feel like this was something that really hadn't been written about until I put it in the book, as opposed to, say, like Singapore, which is a story I've been told many times. But in South Africa, you know,
this is Oriana. Oriana. Is
Orania, that, yeah.
Orania, sorry.
Yeah, so it ends up with a kind of a small all-white Boer enclave that has a CEO instead of a mayor, and they have their own crypto, and it's like super out there. But it was weirdly mainstream in the late apartheid era, the idea that you wouldn't have a single nation state after apartheid, but you would just solve the problem of like the threat of black majority rule by just smashing up South Africa into hundreds or thousands of these small cantons, and then allow people to make their own laws about immigration, representation, and so on. And that would preserve black disempowerment, preserve white property without sort of transgressing the principle of choosing your own government. So those, and the great thing for me as a kind of insight into America and the way people see it is their expressed interest was, how do we get to the United States? How do we get to America where there is rampant racially based segregation? But because it happens through the market rather than by law or edict, people seem to accept it, or at least it's not the grounds for, you know, being sanctioned at the United Nations. So they're like, how do we get kind of segregation from below? And that's the kind of thing that, of course, Friedman was interested in too. That's the idea of school vouchers. You take it out of the hands of the state, you let people choose, and if they choose to live amongst people of their own race, then so be it. How can we stand in the way of individual decision making? The fact that that would likely turn into kind of a resegregated landscape with all of the economic inequalities that come along with it, someone like Milton Friedman would say, I'm not willing to speculate, but other people, including Murray Rothbard, who you mentioned, was happy to speculate. And this was the basis for the coalition between him as what he called a paleo libertarian against the left libertarians who they just saw as a bunch of hippies and libertines and druggies who they wanted to hive off and create a coalition to that group that were called the paleo conservatives, as opposed to the neoconservatives in the early 1990s. And these are the people who were behind Pat Buchanan's two presidential runs in the early 1990s. And in many ways, as people like Nicole Hammer and John Gantz have shown, really like prefigured Trump's politics.
Tucker Carlson feels like we'll
run through the market to get to more racially homogeneous communities.
Tucker Carlson feels like the sort of the product of that to me, where mm-hmm. He is the walking sort of iteration of that. Let me ask you this, because I feel like you will be I suspect you'll be a little bit more charitable than I am in saying, like, is this really even an ideology? Or is it like we are completely sort of backfilling this desire for us to, you know, to justify using our resources to be segregated both from, you know, races we don't like and frankly poor people and everything else is sort of backfilled. I mean, I have always to the extent that, you know, I've had debates with people like this, it always seems to get there that, like, I'm going to choose. I have these really hard and fast principles, but if I choose when to engage, like to the initial point of when I start to calculate that, I just happen to come out on top, coincidentally, every single time. Mm-hmm. And it feels like it's just sort of a rationalization for some material end point that they want to achieve.
Yeah, which is maybe another way of describing what ideology is often, right? I mean, it often is just a kind of a way to produce a justifying set of ideas for the material position that you have found yourself in some cases. But I completely get your question. And I think that my approach both in this book and the last book is very much like that of like steel manning an argument, you know, rather than straw manning, like just, you know, for a second, let's take Balaji Srinivasan seriously as a thinker instead of just like laughing him off, which most people, I think, for very good reasons are willing to do. And let's do that also with someone like David Friedman, who like spends his weekends like dressing up as an 11th century Berber poet and reading poems from a stage. I mean, very easy to kind of dismiss and make fun of. But on the other hand, what if there is a kind of intellectual tradition here, as hard as it can be to discern, that has a kind of generational movement where people argue things in the 1940s and it gets developed across into the 1990s. And what if my proposal with the book is not so much that this is the kind of secret code behind reality, because I don't think it is, nor is it that the world's most powerful people are like secretly Rothbardites, which they're definitely not. It's more that this set of ideas, I think, are very good kind of symptoms of the moment that we find ourselves in, right? So I think that I was talking about this the other day, you know, like Marinetti, the futurist, wrote about like the thrill of being in a car accident and driving a car and the steel and gasoline and so on, like in the 1920s. And, you know, we would study Marinetti on futurism, not because he invented the car or was a great racer, but because he got the car somehow. And I think that's what my characters kind of like, they get the often destructive capacity and direction of capitalism at the present and where they want it to. They're sort of avant-garde in that sense. Like they want to imagine a future where all of the things that are happening now just are continued one step further, two steps forward, three steps forward, right? So the world in which we go about our everyday existence through buying things from each other, operating under contracts, operating with the threat of being sued or fired. Their question is just like, what if our whole existence was just that? And we took out the fact that every 2 years or every 4 years you go to a ballot box, or that there's some idea of like democratic legitimacy that underlies the whole order. What if it was just pure market system and market rationality? And the troubling thing for me is it's not that hard to imagine that, because, like, as I said, like our lives are consumed by those kind of processes already. And so it's kind of like invigorating in the sense of having, you know, like a glass of like cold water splashed in your face to be confronted with people who are just like, take what would to most of us be a dystopia and then remind us that it's actually not as far away as we would expect. So I see them that in that role as kind of diagnosticians of the present moment rather than, you know, like actually writing the blueprints. So the fact that there can be some erraticness to their writing is, I think, the same way that someone like Neal Stephenson or William Gibson can be, you know, have a good novel and a bad novel. But when they're good, you can see that they sort of saw something about the operating system of our present that helps us see our own lives differently.
Is it in any way predictive too? I mean, there's a sort of a prepper quality to a lot of where this is headed. And, you know, I think like, The irony is that many of the sort of government initiatives that they would argue against are in response to the same potential future that they see. It's just for them, the way to deal with this is to go to New Zealand and have very high walls.
Yeah, I mean, in some cases, there's definitely an attempt to kind of, you know, be the difference in the way that they want to see in the world. Then there's examples of that in the book, like attempts to actually create, for example, a sort of quasi offshore, semi extraterritorial space in Honduras, the place called Prospera, which some people might have heard of, which very sort of interestingly and in my mind kind of wonderfully is now deeply in jeopardy because of a democratic election that happened in Honduras last year when a progressive candidate came in and was like, we have to get these gringos out of here. Like they can't be like running their own mini state off the north coast of our country. The operators of that mini state in turn have sued the state of Honduras for $10.8 billion through the Central American Free Trade Agreement. One of the libertarians involved quipping that, even though libertarians don't like international law, it turns out it can be really helpful sometimes.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's very easy to just show the kind of hypocrisy and contradiction and often just frankly bullshit at the heart of a lot of this stuff. But I think that it is the case that if given kind of full leash, then they can both help accelerate the catastrophe that they're predicting while also like being the only ones selling, you know, life preservers. Like that's really the business plan. Someone like Srinivasan, who I mentioned a second ago, will like fill the timelines of his many hundreds of thousands of followers on social media to predict the crack up of the American dollar and the idea that the Fed is leading us towards like Hungarian interwar style hyperinflation. And then at the same time have a link to be able to buy Bitcoin through one of the exchanges that he's involved in, right? So that gold bug catastrophizing sort of self-realizing prophecy is absolutely, I think, one of the main political modes of our time in a way, right? Like you talk up the emergency, you help create the emergency, and then you offer your assistance as the only solution to the emergency. So I think this gang is also useful to look at as sort of prime examples of that.
The book is Crack Up Capitalism, Market Radicals, and the Dream of a World Without Democracy, Quinn Slobodian. We will put a link to that at majority.fm in our podcast and YouTube. Thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate it. Fascinating stuff.
It was nice to talk. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break and head into the fun half of the program. We will take your phone calls. We will play some clips. Steven Crowder has put out a statement in response to his ex-wife and her family's statement in response to his statement, which was in response to Candace Owens' statement.
He just wants to keep this private.
Yeah. Not going to leak any
private. Want to protect the kids by telling everybody that their mother has, I'm going to release her medical records.
Yeah, I'm not going to. Yeah, I want to keep this private.
Yep.
But if I have to, I won't.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show free of commercials, you get the fun half, you get to IM us via the via the app. I've been talking about this for a while, the whole move of advertising from dynamic advertising. People have probably noticed this over the past couple of years. Our advertising is slowly diminished. We're down probably 60-70% from where we were 2 years ago. Not because our numbers are down, but because of this dynamic advertising. So we are shopping around for a new place that still does embedded ads like we do it.
They're trying to control us.
They're trying to. It's an authoritarian big tech thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is that a daily show does not have the long tail that a much easier show to do like WTF, let's say Mark Maron show, like one where it's just you could do it just like roll out of bed and just do it twice a week. That has a longer tail for whatever reason because. Mm. People want to hear from famous people, I guess. I don't know. I'm not maligning Maron's show. It's fine.
Yeah, it just came to mind.
It just came to mind. But our show, we get all our views and our listens within 3 days, 4 days. And so there's no value in the dynamic advertising. But if an entire company goes towards selling dynamic advertisements and we're all our value is on non-dynamic advertising, then in round peg, square hole, that's the way that we actually, I think literally that came up in mm-hmm. the conversation I had with the guy last week. So, but it is your memberships that allow us to make it through the leaner times. So, your memberships help us survive and thrive. Sometimes it's survive, sometimes it's thrive. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget the AM Quickie. AMQuickie.com. Top 5 stories in your email box every day. I don't know if it's 5. Do we do 5?
Hmm.
Is it always 5? It's 3 to 5. 3 to 6.
3 to 6.
Who knows? Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. You will get 10% off. Buy the Majority Report blend. Do yourself a favor. Bruins.
Yeah, we'll be talking about the Bruins, his best regular season in the history of the NHL in the post-salary cap era, losing in the first round.
The curse continues.
To the Matthew Tkachuk-led Panthers. We'll be talking about that. The defending champions, Avalanche, also choking. And the Leafs advancing, so we're living in a very bizarre world. But also Steph Curry, still dominant, setting a Game 7 record against the Kings. And we'll be talking NFL draft winners and losers, youtube.com/ESPN show.
And Matt, still basking in the glow of his post-grand jury life?
Yeah, I'm basking in the glow of that traumatizing experience.
Well, it was either basking in the glow or literally just still trying to recover.
Yeah, I'm still trying to get up to speed. But we do have a good show for patrons, patreon.com/leftreckoning. Go subscribe to that. We did a show where we talked about the North Dakota young Republicans who got busted with a Telegram channel saying a bunch of racist things.
What?
You would be surprised to say. And then when they were caught, someone took a screenshot of saying one of the people caught saying, "Hey, thanks to whoever leaked our screenshot to the conservative journalist in North Dakota, Rob Port," and then said, "Happy Hanukkah." So some good old fashioned anti-Semitism from the future of the Republican Party. These are the people who voted against school lunch and voted for raising their reimbursements and also a record setting 10 anti-LGBT laws the same day. And there turns out a bunch of crypto Nazis. Mm. And so we went into details there, including one of whom lying about law school in a sort of George Santos fashion. So patreon.com/leftreckoning. We got Chris James of Not Even a Show tomorrow night to talk about pranking people who, for instance, vote against school lunch bills.
I've made this point many times. I think for people who are bigoted that way, they wouldn't say I'm not, racist and anti-Semitic. There's no difference. It's all right. Just people who are different than me.
And it's all these 24-year-old little shits, and one of them was
edgelord types.
Who like is like, I'm gay myself. I couldn't say anything against the tide of this Telegram channel because then they would target me. And it's like, you actually look at what he said, and it was I'm gay, but I'm not a F, and who cares about pride, and also like going after trans people. So it's a little rancid.
So Dave Rubin
group they have there.
if you wanna start to understand that, start with Hannah Arendt's The Banality of Evil. And then work your way to Errol Morris's Dr. Death, I think it was. Is that what the name of it was?
Hmm.
Was it Dr. Death? Errol Morris?
I haven't seen it.
Just Google it, because I can't. I always get the name wrong. But it was basically like this guy who was working for...
Mr. Death,
yes. He was working for like prisons and providing like advice on how to do executions, and sort of basically the neo-Nazis adopted him because he could ostensibly prove that there was no Holocaust. But it's just like you see, like, if you want to know like how a kid like that is like, I just got caught up in this and I got sort of swept up in it and was trying to avoid, like, there's another way you could avoid them not dealing with you. It's just like, my mom says I can't use Telegram anymore.
Yeah. And one of the Pritchard, the guy who has the George Santos Law School thing, responded to an article saying, hey, can you clarify, did you actually go to University of Minnesota Law School? And he said, I'll give you documentation if you remove the names of my friends who you reported in that Telegram channel thing. And he later pointed to like a sort of publicly available seminar that University of Minnesota provided. So he wasn't actually going to learn.
Shocking.
Yeah.
All right. 646-257-3920.
20.
Yep. I just saw this Isaac saying, I'd like to remind everyone the Majority Report is on Twitch. Twitch.tv, the Majority Report, pretty much every day. Someone comes into Twitch chat like, MR is on Twitch? Nobody on Twitch would hear this unless they're watching us via Twitch.
Mm-hmm.
So you know what that tells me? The Twitchers who are watching us on Twitch are not doing their job.
Whoa. Calling them out.
Still, I think you guys are poggers, and let's get a hype train going. So, all right, see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Who sent us
this? Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflakes has what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare!
Can we bring back DJ Dan?
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dan.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. Hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black.
black and the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100.
Can't knock the hustle.
Come on. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday. Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on.
To pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.